Well, hi, everybody. This is Dave. I hope you're all doing great. Again, I appreciate the notes and questions you've sent in. I want to address, while we're still on open mic, any questions that you have or reflections or observations. I want to mention a couple that I haven't answered as directly, and this is a work in progress to answer them, but some of the questions you've sent in, I wanted to respond to one in particular about a fear of failing and being afraid of losing everything and then wanting to have clarity and confidence and faith about beginning something new. Now, that's not the way it happens. Okay. Now, but I can tell you, and you are hearing a more systematic way to go about it. You will be hearing, and if you haven't already heard, in your coaching client's narrative, you will hear limiting assumptions like, I need to have confidence in order to move ahead. I need to feel comfortable to engage in this new endeavor. These are limiting assumptions because this is not how you begin. Comfortable is not a prerequisite. Confident is not a way to proceed because you haven't done it yet. So here's the dynamic, as I see it, of what happens when you stop yourself and have a fear or have other negative self-talk. When you begin to take a step that's new or different, there's a natural discomfort, uncertainty. Anything we do that's new or different, our brain lets us know that this isn't what's expected. Our mind says this is not what we programmed software for all this time. So it reads as discomfort. Now, if you interpret that as if it's a wrong choice or your gut's telling you it's not right or as if you need to be comfortable or confident to start, you will stop yourself. Then instantly that creates a state of mind change. And you become afraid or any other negative self-talk because it makes it make sense to stop. So it's not about having comfort or confidence. It's about having a system. So, and knowing about money is not an answer or not a complete one at least. It's about knowing your operating system, how it works for a better foundation applied to your engagement, understanding, processing of all things related to money. Here's an example that bumps up against another question, a really excellent question you all have sent in, about working with couples in this area. Let's take an example. One partner has money wired in the whole brain mechanism is security. That's what money means to this partner. Now, money to the other partner means freedom. So with these very different meanings and systems, the one who has freedom as a meaning is going to enjoy spending, wanting to live out freedom, and this is what money provides. The other, for whom money means security, the main objective is saving and having a nest egg and having that security that money represents. So there's going to be a major discrepancy about how that dollar bill is viewed by those two people. This is where your mentor coaching comes in, your couples coaching, to look at and understand and help them navigate and create a compromise and agreement to collaborate about what they do that will be different for each of them. So these are just some early examples. And what I want to do is emphasize after our next seminar, last seminar next week, yes, we will, unfortunately, since I didn't notice it, meet Memorial Day. So I hope you can join me. I'd like to extend that time after the top of the hour for any discussion, question and answer, things you'd like to talk about that we may not have covered or may not have covered sufficient for your experience or hopes of what we do. So thoughts or questions from anyone that you want to add or ask at this point? Yeah, I'm sorry. I'll talk to you if you call me Dave. Who is this?
Okay, Dave. This is Enyla. How are you?
Welcome. How are you? Great.
Yeah, thank you.
Can you get a little closer to your microphone and tell me what you said again, please?
Sure. I was just trying. Thank you. Just recapping on maybe seminar one and two, kind of going into the money story piece, and you just made the comment about the couple instance. Some of the things that I do, I think about, you know, I kind of say who's the saver and who's the spender. But now in understanding that each of us have a narrative when it comes to our money story, how do we take that part and delve a little bit deeper into that person who thinks about security versus the person who thinks about spending?
Okay, yeah, that's a great question. So the preface for that answer is we each have a conviction that we see things as the way they are, that our beliefs and our responses are determined by objective perceptions. The saver totally believes in that and has a whole system that's wired to perceive, process, and follow up in that way. Same with whatever those beliefs are. And just given the right information, other rational and reasonable people would reach the same conclusions that we reach, right? No, you guys know that from coaching. So here's a short list of some anatomical realities in your brain. Facts, beliefs, identity, patterns such as attachment, emotional, behavioral, how you deal with money. So when you want to understand and possibly change something, you need something other than facts and beliefs and better ideas, because that's not going to rewrite suddenly anything that's scripted in someone's brain. That's where the roadmap system that we're looking at is for you. It's not necessarily for your clients, but it's to help you understand a systematic approach. So we've covered the first three steps of the roadmap. Remember, is a system to understand fundamental algorithms of decisions, consciously and unconsciously, and how to change those basic assumptions and ways of operating. And remember, 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. So this is a way to really listen for and understand someone's operating system. Just as I talked about, you hear someone having, well, I need to be comfortable in order to start. I need to be confident before I can launch my new business. Those are assumptions that don't work. That's not the way it happens. So this is what we've talked about so far. First, we recognize authorship. So this is a way to help for you as a coach to recognize that someone is writing their money story, the assumptions, every choice about how they regard money, earning, spending, saving, and they are not aware that this is a story. They're not aware that this is an algorithm. It's just the way things are. Second, to own their story, to recognize that they are attaching meaning. They are interpreting this. This is an accountability that we create our story. Every day is a blank page. We write automatically because that's how we're hardwired and our software is predetermined. But this is to recognize that it doesn't happen until you create it, even though it's been automatic. And we're going to apply that in just a little bit. So the third step is to assess the plot and the storylines, to recognize the behaviors, the messages, the elusive language of mind and emotion. These are ways that we listen as a coach. So what we're going to look at today in the next two steps of the roadmap system, to decide what to change and how to make informed choices about what aspects, what part of the story do we keep, do we let go, do we change or enhance, and then to map changes, to establish goals and success strategies. So we're looking at understanding a story to see what works and what doesn't work, to do more of what works, and to create a way that our client can understand that and use and enhance that even when we're not on the other end of the communication. In the next week, we'll talk about author new experiences to create a new story and then to program new identity, a huge aspect. So that's kind of an overview of what we're talking about, and I want to use much more experience near language, because what I just said, that's not how we talk to clients. That's how I don't talk to you guys, because this is training. But and that's part of a client is not telling us their money story. They're telling us the way it is, how they see it, experience it, what's happening, what their hopes, what their aspirations, what their struggles are, what's not working. This is simply a way for us to hear it and apply a system. And the roadmap system, the seven steps, is simply one system. It's a macro system of how you create a story. Now, there are others. This is my favorite, my most used one, and one I've created and used for some time, and I wanted to share it with you. But this is not the only way. It's simply one way of understanding. Does that overview help you put this in perspective in asking that question, which is a great question, by the way?
It does. It just makes me understand that, you know, when you talk about applying the system, it is a process, and so it's not an event.
Yes.
So thank you.
Exactly. Okay, I'm going to put us on lecture mode, and I want to say, was there another question that or comment that I missed? Well, let me put us on lecture mode then, and I'm hoping to have a little bit of time at the end for any questions or comments. But if we don't get to it, we'll do that at the end of next seminar, the top of the hour, and add some time on if you have things to discuss. Okay, we're going to talk about the next step. We've discussed the concept of your money story, your relationship with money, and the first three steps of understanding how to recognize, own, and assess that story. So we're going to discuss the next two steps. To decide, step four, decide what to change in your money story. And change isn't just about recognizing it to make it go away or having a better idea, which doesn't overwrite old behavior. Let me tell you a study and have you guess the biggest change impact of this story. Ben Fletcher, the University of Hertfordshire in the UK, devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. Every day, the volunteers chose a different option from polls of contrasting behaviors, lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive. They would choose one of these two poles and behave according to their choice for the day. So an introverted person, for example, if they picked extrovert, they would become an extrovert. They would act, behave as an extrovert for that day. Additionally, twice weekly, they stretched to do something that they had never done before, according to this research protocol. They would twice a week, they would eat something that they had never eaten before, and twice a week, they would read something that they had never read before, a different genre, a different kind of writing. So, what do you think the biggest change in this group was after 4 months of doing this every weekday, 5 days a week, choosing one, then doing something else? What do you think the biggest change was? After 4 months, the subjects had lost an average of 11 pounds. Now, the researchers were baffled. 6 months later, almost all had kept their weight off. Most continued to lose weight. And this wasn't a diet. It was a study focusing on change and its impact. Now, what they found in looking closely is that when people changed their routine and became conscious of their choices and actually consciously focused on what they chose rather than doing things automatically, they began to be more subjectively aware of their choices. They began to wonder, what choices are in my best interest? Many of them even got to the point of looking at each bite of food as a choice and wondering, is this bite in my best interest? Think about how that's exactly what we do in coaching, to look at helping someone become aware of their choice architecture, of what they behave or do if something's not working. And that disruption, that breaking the script of having someone become actively aware that they choose what they do, how they think, feel, experience, what they eat, that's a disruptor, but it also creates more self-reflection and self-awareness. Every action is a choice. Every thought and feeling is a choice. So that's a study that they didn't expect those kinds of results, but it affected how people go about making choices. That's exactly what we do in mentor coaching. We help someone become aware of their choices, of the automatic choices that comprise then ultimately the storylines and their thoughts and feelings and behaviors. But if it's not working, then we highlight it. So remember last seminar, we discussed this equation. Belief drives behavior. Behavior drives performance. And for this step, decide what to change, I want to add another equation. It captures the principle that you either create your reality or agree to it. Whatever we experience, whatever we think and feel and experience, we create each moment. Whatever we experience, we either create or we agree to. So, here's the equation. Event plus response equals outcome. Every outcome you experience in life is a result of how you respond to the event. Achievement's an outcome. It's a result of responding in certain ways. You worked out, so now you feel more energy and alertness. You didn't attend to marketing, so now your business is slumping. You spent more than you earned, so now you have debt. Choice is part of a mindset. The antithesis of choice is also a mindset with its own text. And this is how that sounds. Fate, luck, circumstance, bad traffic, things just happen. I can't do it. And the awareness of choice is important to not limit possibility. The absence of awareness of choice can limit possibility, to say that differently. So here's a footnote to consider. whatever you're doing that you feel you can't control is your addiction. You can be addicted to a substance, a behavior, such as spending beyond your means, to a process, such as death, a certain kind of relationship, or to compromised results, or simply to stopping and repeating that pattern and identifying it as being a procrastinator, which makes it harder to change if you cluster your definition of your decisions as if it were a given. So, here's another notion to consider. What you seek is camouflaged in what you fear. So, here's an example. Or let me say that just a different way. Show me an obstacle, and I'll show you a desire. For example, show me clutter, I'll show you blocked energy that desires release. We always create the outside to match the inside. So, rather than strategizing to overcome or avoid or defeat an obstacle, simply consider not creating it. It's there when you create it. Consider using your energy to generate something else instead. So instead of asking a client, what's blocking you, as if that's a noun, as if there's an obstacle to overcome or circumvent or strategize around, let's look at how you stop yourself. So there's a secret here. An obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. It reminds you of what you want, but it makes it seem safe to want it if you're afraid and don't proceed. Here's an example. I saw a cartoon of a dog straining at its leash, barking ferociously at a cat, as if to say, just let me at him. Now, the next frame, the cat was not too shabby. It actually looked pretty mean, almost as big as the dog. Then, all of a sudden, in the middle of a ferocious bark, let me out, the leash snapped. So the dog was free to go after the cat. He looked back, was astonished, scared to death. He ran back, quickly grabbed the leash, tied a triple knot. Then he could again safely strain at the leash and bark his fiery, just let me at him. Now, here's another example of this dialectic of obstacle and desire. If you view a scene in a film you don't want to see, you cover your face with your hands as if to say, nah, I don't want to look at that. I don't want to see that. But then desire creeps in and you peek through your fingers at what you're drawn to see. The obstacle makes looking seem as if it's acceptable. So, if you find yourself, or here in your client, focusing on an obstacle, well, I can't find time to exercise. I can't put away any savings. Reflect on the underlying desire. So here's the coaching principle. When you're ready to consider that you create the obstacle, you're also ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. So imagine what it would be like not to create your obstacles. The primary obstacles people give for not participating, for example, in retirement plans include fear of finances, inertia, procrastination, I don't know enough. The way you frame an issue makes a great deal of difference. Here's an example. When a company automatically enrolls their employees in retirement savings plan, the employee then has to opt out to not participate. They have to make a decision, I do not want to save for the future. So initially, it's 100% by definition. Then it levels out to 86 to 94% of people who stay in the plan who decide they want to save for their retirement. Now, at companies where this isn't automatic and someone has to, on the front end, choose to opt in, 20% participate. A four-fold difference based on the framing. So these are just some things to think about. Now, the huge non-secret here, you can set up your own automatic contribution to automatically deduct a set amount from your checking account to deposit into your retirement account each month. It's one decision. You don't have to debate it every time. You don't have to put, it's one good decision that will make a difference for your future. So let's look at change and the brain, because this is crucial, I think, to understand when we engage change and when we traffic in change, which is our specialty. Both our minds and brains automatically resist change. So let's first look at how the brain opposes change and then how to use this information to facilitate success. One, people have prior knowledge that affects how they hear and respond to new information. Those things that I mentioned that are anatomical realities in our brain, facts, data, any kind of new information, even beliefs. And when we hear someone who presents a different fact or a different belief, without being consciously aware, we compare what we hear to what we already think or feel or believe. If it fits, if there's a synchrony, then we will select ways to consciously agree with that, confirmation bias. If it is opposed to what we think or believe or what we, quote, know, then we'll find a way to refute it. That's the boomerang effect. The more flexible and intellectual someone is, the stronger the effect will be of something they agree with and something they disagree with. So this is why presenting facts and new information is not enough. But existing knowledge is the beginning of new knowledge. This is why we want to elicit from a client, how do you see that, or what is your belief, or how are you addressing that now? That way there's nothing to oppose. You ask a question. Two, the prior knowledge is physical, real, and persistent as a neuronal pathway in the brain. This is just another way of saying what we just talked about. Facts and beliefs are anatomical realities in the brain. Now, every time you engage them, it etches a little bit further. If you don't engage it, create something new or different, or look at a challenge, you're creating new neuronal networks and pathways in a beginning way in your brain. Now, if we ignore reality, it will get in the way of new information and change. This is one we have to begin with where the client is rather than with where we are. And lastly, when change occurs in a systematic and consistent way, new connections are made in the brain. New maps are created. So let's look at how the brain opposes change. The brain has a mind of its own. So I think it's helpful to consider how our brains work in order to strategically collaborate with our clients, first maybe with ourselves, but then with our clients, about how to plan change. Now, each of these precepts can help you craft your new money story and to consider it for clients, because it's a way of facilitating change in your brain, beginning with how it operates anyhow. Now, these principles are so simple, they're almost elusive. One, change generates discomfort. Activities that we've repeated, that have become habits, become hardwired into our brain. That's why practice doesn't make perfect. Practice makes permanent. So you need to practice in the right way, because only perfect practice makes perfect performance. So this is what we want to be aware of what assumptions and beliefs and ways of operating are, so we know where to begin to look at crafting an initial step, not an abstract notion. Remember, even winners and losers have the same goals, but how to create a system. So the promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. Brain just doesn't know it yet, so our minds have to lead the way. So that's how we stay in business, actually, as coaches. Some remarkable new research shows that consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expressions. Beliefs turn genes on or turn them off. In fact, I've heard him say this in person. Ray Kurzweil said, and this is in his book, The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology, civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them. Yogi Berra said it way more simply. I can't think and hit at the same time. How the brain opposes change, too. Change creates dissonance, a discomfort. We see what we expect to see, what our radar has been coded for, and when we don't see what we expect, the brain's error detection mechanism reads as if something's wrong. Our brain, this is an actual anatomical reality in our brain. It's very close to the emotional center of what neuroscientists call errors, which is simply the difference between what we expect because of repetition and hardwiring and what we actually perceive. And it registers as a sense that something's not quite right. So this discomfort is going to be a register of any experience that's new and different. Every client with every step into a new or different experience is going to have this vague discomfort. And that's where we can help them reframe that in an understandable way as, this is a step into something new and different. It's not going to feel comfortable in the beginning. So we help them reframe their experience as a signpost of progress, a validation of being in new territory. So we can deceive others, even our own mind. And an example is you buy something you can't afford, and your brain, though, knows the difference. Your brain always knows. Now, the good news, the neural machinery can both recognize and correct errors and optimize behavior by responding to mistakes. Now, this is important, but it's important to remember whether it's a mistake or a neural response to change itself, like doing something really new and different. Three, how the brain opposes change. Three, the brain is a prediction machine. Let me tell you some numbers. And if you want to write them down or just think about it, here are the numbers. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, 8. What's missing? Maybe usual answers of 3 and 6? Multiples of 3? Well, consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head. It's informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd repetition. A stock goes up 2 quarters in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd rise will follow. J. Paul Getty said, there are 3 key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. Now, you can see how brain prediction of pattern is also the basis of some jokes. You list 2 things and then a 3rd non sequitur, set up, payoff. So the human brain automatically imposes patterns and predictions on repeated events. This makes it a challenge to override what's already there to make wise and balanced decisions. So we need to be sure we predict or envision the right things. 4, behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Let's say you're the COO of a company determining a policy about employees being on time. What do you think works better, threats or reinforcements? The answer is neither. They're both likely to backfire because they focus on the negative instead of what you really want to engage someone to do. We assume people are going to receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Well, not so, says the brain. In fact, being told what to do results in an innate opposition. The brain's natural homeostasis says, avoid change. 5, motivation is not essential. How many of you, if you've done coach-the-coach sessions in training or with your coaching, have heard a client say, well, you know, I just need to get motivated to work out or to eat better, or any number of things? here's an important way to look at that, I think. Motivation isn't necessary. That's simply a limiting assumption that you got to wait till you get motivated to do it. You only need two things to change. Your client only needs two things to change, a plan and to stick to it. I work with pro athletes for some of my coaching and actors. They're not motivated to get up and go to the gym every day, but they do because they know they need to do that in order to do what's next. All they need is a plan and to stick to it. As I mentioned in the example, you don't have to be motivated to save for retirement. You make one good decision, and it's done. You don't have to think about it again. 6, emotions change brain functioning. When emotions are triggered, the brain chemicals dopamine and adrenaline are released that prompt toward action and away from creativity and assessing knowledge. This is why self-talk is limited at times. One of the great philosophers of the 21st century actually put this really simply. Everybody has a plan till they get punched in the mouth. Now, of course, that was Mike Tyson. So when there's a possibility of a reward, dopamine's released to produce an excited state in order to anticipate that reward. And that's self-perpetuating, spending money, a risky stock investment, approaching a slot machine. What we know now, if you hook somebody up to an fMRI, as they approach the slot machine, the anticipation of reward creates a spike of dopamine before they ever touch the machine. Same with spending. Same with other things that are anticipated. In fact, Stephen King said, you know, all an author ever has to do is to keep the reader asking, what happens next? So people can fall easily into an unconscious pursuit of various things like compulsive spending just to keep that pleasure going, or as we're on an hedonic treadmill, since it takes more and more stimulation to have the same effect, it needs to escalate a little bit more next time. That's why more never has an end result. We can come back to that in a discussion. Another stimulation and performance. Stimulation, also known as a little bit of stress, enhances memory and learning. But for longer periods of time, especially like 3 to 4 hours or more, things go the other direction. Learning capacity declines. So that means with sustained stress, people can make bad emotionally charged decisions or situations that really deplete their energy. For most important success strategy stories, it's about regulation of states of mind and management of emotion. 8, closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people can close themselves to novelty, to new situations as they get older. The major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, like been in a particular business. People who stay in one place in one position get most entrenched. For example, a place that I see this is working a particular resistance in coaching is family succession of business. A patriarch founder passes the company he started 34 years ago to 2 children to own and manage. It's a challenge because everyone has to change roles, relationships, and functioning. Now, here are the last two principles I think are huge in strategizing change. 2 things, above all others, create neurogenesis, new brain cells, an enriched environment, and exercise. And this was initially studied in rats by stimulating their experience and by doing exercise. Intellectual and emotional stimulation creates more complex brain tissue. to co-create, to stimulate thinking, to challenge, not in rants, but in clients, to story bus. This is all of what we do with clients. Now, here's what's happening. The hippocampus is the part of the brain, part of the midbrain, that's particularly connected with creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have 15% increase in the number of their hippocampal cells. What's your guess about how much exercise increases cells, number of cells in the hippocampus? Almost 100%. Now, these findings were recently replicated in non-invasive human studies, London taxicab drivers, University of Hamburg medical students. Another finding of what increases the number of cells in the hippocampus, the creativity and exercise, here's a parallel finding. What is it that decreases the number of cells in the hippocampus? Not just hold steady, but decreases. Stress, chronic stress, impairs neurogenesis. And finally, number 10, neuroplasticity simply means that our brains remodel themselves. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain, in other words, can reassign job descriptions of neurons, rezoning and developing cortical real estate. Here's one example. Some NASA astronauts did a training experiment in which they had headgear with a visual apparatus that was in exact upside-down position. Everything was upside down, 24 hours a day. So they had to learn to think very carefully before every movement was made. Then about day 25, their brains automatically made, they were in this headgear for 24 hours a day, automatically made the adjustments. They didn't have to be that careful anymore. Their brains had developed new neural pathways. Now, another group of astronauts in that same headgear were given a day off, 24 hours out of the headgear at day 15. When they put the headgear back on, it took them 25 days from that point on for their brains to automatically rewire. So when we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Let's talk about step five, about mapping changes. This is huge in coaching because this is exactly what we do in collaboration with our clients, is to create each coaching session for that coaching story a map, a focus, a destination, the development of that, a summary, and then a commitment. A man approached J.P. Morgan, held up an envelope, said, "Sir, in my hand, I hold a guaranteed formula for success." This was way back when $25,000 really was big money. He said, "I'll gladly sell it to you for $25,000. J.P. Morgan said, "Well, I don't know what's in the envelope, but if you show it to me and I like it, I give you my word as a gentleman, I will pay you what you ask." The man agreed to those terms, considering the options, handed over the envelope. This is before the current century. Last century, J.P. Morgan opened it, extracted a single sheet of paper, gave it one look, a brief glance, then handed the paper back to the man and wrote him a check for $25,000. There were two sentences on the page. "Every morning, write a list of things that need to be done that day. Do them. $25,000. There are six crucial elements to map change. We'll talk about how to understand and incorporate each of these six in a brief overview to master your money story. One, regulate states of mind. This is important to make a grounded and centered decision where you can have access to all of the information in all of your states of mind, and to blend that and to synthesize it into good judgment, because states of mind are like software programs. A mind-body state can determine how we perceive and process information. We have different states of mind, different software programs. relaxation, alertness, anxiety, anger, centered attention. So a key element is to be aware of our different states, to be grounded and centered, and then to decide what state works best for what task. A simple example, writing and editing. Writing is a particular state of mind that needs to be engaged and sustained. Editing, different part of the brain, different state of mind, to engage the one that's going to work, not go back and forth, to sustain it. And be sure your brain is working with you. So this is important to look at how we engage what's going to work best. Then you can respond when your state of mind is balanced. Number two element to map change, the power is in the focus. Now, this is the neuroscience and quantum mechanics behind the law of attraction. Thoughts have a frequency and energy field. Focus selects that frequency. All the channels of a radio or satellite TV are available. We choose the channel, the frequency, out of thousands of possibilities. We each transmit and receive a frequency through our thoughts. So this is what's important about focus. First question that we ask usually of a client, what would you like to focus on? That aligns the energy field of the client, and in a collaborative way, we're both focusing on the same thing. So this is what we're addressing as a systematic beginning. And this is what's important in terms of developing a systematic approach is first about focus, because that aligns the energy field of the brain. So this is not important just for someone who has attention challenges, but this is important for all attention. And this is what Einstein talked about, I believe, when he talked about the unified field theory, that we are each a bundle of energy. When we interact with someone, we interact with their energy field and co-create a collaborative third. Same with a group. Think about how the energy field of a group can affect what's happening. I think a simple example is the NBA. 84 games a year. 42 are at home, 42 away. Every team in the NBA loses more games away than at home, wins more games at home than away. Think about the collective energy field of 70,000 people who are wanting a team to win, sending positive energy, or just the opposite. We can return to some examples. I've done demos in live presentations that can illustrate this. So here's the power of focus. Whatever you attend to or focus on, you align yourself to create, and this is basically what the law of attraction and visualization is about. So be sure you focus on the right thing. Here are some bad examples. I want to get out of debt. Well, it's a negative focus. It's on debt. I want to lose weight. Focus on overweight. Here's one that's kept a lot of dry cleaners happy. I want to be really careful not to spill something on this new outfit. So focus on what you want. The brain can't tell, your brain can't tell the difference between a positive or negative focus, just what you focus on. So be sure it's what you want to align yourself to create, to focus on. Visualizing changes is a part of that. Here's a prototype study that initiated this some time ago. Basketball players at Ohio State were divided into three groups to practice shooting free throws. One group, no practice for a month. Another group, 30 minutes of practice daily. Another group, they imagine shooting perfect free throws, nothing but net, for at least 5 minutes a day for those 30 days. At the end of 30 days, the first group, no practice, no improvement. The second group, actual practice, 24% improvement. The third group, practiced by visualization only a sixth of the time, 23% improvement. Now, subsequent studies, the visualization and the evolved use of visualization creates better results in a setting like that than the actual practice, because if you practice and miss, you've grooved it a little bit off, so there has to be a self-correct. So this is where creating an image of your goal can be helpful to live into it. Visualization crystallizes possibility into an articulated idea, and the experience, when done repeatedly, can change the brain. So a vision can serve as guide and inspiration to design ways to realize it, to live into it. Four, this is huge for us as coaches. Insight changes the brain. If we were to look with an fMRI study at the brain at a time of an aha experience, a moment of insight, three different parts of the brain will light up, which vaults someone into a state of mind that's more integrative, synthetic, and creative. Here's what data, information, and facts do. Nothing changes. An important aspect of insight-induced change is that it's the sustained attention and the system of creating new steps or change that hardwires it into the brain circuit. Five, take action. The world is not going to pay you for what you know. It'll pay you for what you do. It rewards action. To analyze and plan are important, but you know that payday comes with action. Winners develop a plan according to a system and set it into motion. It may not be perfect from the beginning. They may need to self-correct, keep moving forward, learn from mistakes, and produce results. This is a growth mindset. This is what we coach toward with our clients. A fixed mindset is what we, through a collaborative alliance, hopefully can challenge and help someone evolve from that. Now, this is a prelude to what we're going to discuss next time. The sixth step is to transform identity. The most powerful force of the human psyche is the bedrock of our identity, so much so that if we do something that's different, introduce any change, then unless that's incorporated into our operating system, the bedrock of our identity, we'll revert back to our core identity. So this is the challenge with clients as we help them change and evolve, to help them transform their identity, their bedrock operating system, to recognize, incorporate, and evolve that system so that it matches what they're doing in terms of change and transformation on the circle, on the surface. So this is an important aspect. So let's apply this in one way to, here's an application that'll combine deciding and mapping change. These two steps, four and five, that we've addressed. Let's apply it to your debt story. So I'd recommend doing these three exercises under the debt story in step five. And I think that begins in what you have on page 5.10. So here's the debt cycle stealth. You can fulfill a desire you didn't know you had by spending money you don't have. You can define yourself by acquisitions not paid for. You can even borrow based on how much money you'll be lended rather than how much money you can pay back. Spending money can generate the perception, both by the spender and the observer, of having money. Fulfilling a wish can create the desire. When desires define identity, that makes that quest unrelenting. So people can fall heavily into debt and not necessarily have psychological problems, but spending takes on a life of its own. With spending, the chase is on. They then try to afford what they buy, and money can never buy what it represents emotionally. My very first client who told me that she had waited for me to begin my practice in coaching worked with me, and I can't say anything more to keep it non-recognizable. We had worked together on a weekly basis for about 3 months, and then finally she said, Dave, I want to tell you something. And she was an expert in an area that interfaces with what she's about to say in a very different way. She said, I've accumulated $500,000 of credit card debt, and it's taken me this long to admit it. I need you to help me with this. And that's when our coaching really began. We had developed an alliance that she knew I was not going to be critical, judgmental, pejorative, that I was in it for helping her. And then finally, she built the courage to do that, and we addressed that. So the most common way we're short-sighted in our decision-making is that we may choose a small amount of something now rather than a larger amount of something in the future. So here are some possibilities to counter these tendencies, and I want to summarize them to see if you have any questions. Neuroeconomist Ben Seymour, University College London, has shown that imagining a future purchase can have the same effect in the brain as getting it. Saving is easier when it's for something specific that we can envision. For example, it's easier and more specific to create a distinct vision for each goal, like a vacation, like a college tuition, like a new house. Tangibly calculate the cost of debt so that it becomes real figures. Concretely represent the magic of compound interest, like in a retirement account. Figure out what money you spend right now would be worth in 5 years, in 10 years, at retirement. Here's an example. Investing $1.50 every day, beginning at age 20, based on the stock market average growth from 1926 till the closing bell today, by age 65, would be worth $1 million. Wait until age 21 instead of starting at 20, the difference is $109,000. Here's another. Investing $2,000 per year in an IRA beginning at age 18 and then stopping all investment by age 20, by age 65, would be worth $1 million. Here's another example. Credit cards can segment the pleasure of spending from the pain of future payment. These guys know this. Our bias makes, well, rainy days and repayment, that's tomorrow. Rationalization is in proportion to elastic boundaries. Payoff, 3 months, 12 months. Here's what we know, and I'm sure you guys have heard this. People who spend who purchase with a credit card spend 23% more than when they pay cash or with a check. A recent economic study showed that credit card holders are consciously aware, even at all aware, clueless, except for $4 of every $10 they owe. Only aware of it, not denying it or saying, well, it's close to, just totally unaware of that $6 out of every 10. Debt has been called a secret sin because of the shame attached. Now, here's what one expert had to say about it. Uncle Junior said to his nephew, Tony Soprano, you know, your father and me started that poker game over 30 years ago. We were talking about it one day, about how the credit card companies, you know, they work their angle. They don't care what you bought as long as you don't pay all at once. They juice you to death, and you thank them for letting you have a card. You'd rather be juiced than pay all at once. It's a certain kind of player. That's why we call it the executive game. So we render money an abstraction and deceive ourselves. Well, I can do it on my credit card, so it won't be an immediate expense. And Richard Medley put it very succinctly, free money makes you stupid. And remember this from everything you've heard today, maybe even all of our three seminars, right now, saving and the future are both abstractions. There'll be a time when they become very real. We're in conversation mode. We don't have nearly as much time as I thought. Any thoughts or questions you want to add or ask before we have to stop? I want to respect the time, even though I squeezed the strike zone to go right up to it. Any thoughts or questions or for future discussion you'd like to add to the hopper? Anyone? Well, I want to keep it open if you think of something or want to add or ask or tag for discussion at next time or at the end of our seminar next time, fire me an email, and I promise I'll respond, either incorporating it into the discussion or we'll discuss it at the end. So thanks for all of the kind words and the responses. I look forward to picking up right here next time and to a discussion at the end if you have anything. So thanks very, very much. Take good care of yourselves and have a great week. See you guys.
Thank
Bye.
You.
Absolutely.
Good night.
See you now.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Good night.
Good night.